This is Valley Edition. Rising global temperatures aren't just an international concern, they're also an important local issue, especially when it comes to public health. How will climate change affect everything from rates of asthma and valley fever to wildfires and natural disasters? Those are just some of the questions asked in a new book called Fevered: Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. The book's author, award-winning health and science journalist Linda Marsa, joins us now. Linda, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Joe.
You've been covering this issue for a while now. How did you come to write this particular book about these more localized effects of this global phenomena that we're so concerned about?
Well, obviously, as a science journalist, I was very aware of the problems with climate change, but a lot has been written about it, to be honest. And I thought, how can I write about this in a fresh, interesting way? And I guess about 4 years ago when I got started writing the book, there was this report in The Lancet, which is a very esteemed British science journal, about how the public health aspect of climate change has not been dealt with at all, and it's really actually the number one public health issue that we're going to be confronting in the 21st century. And then after that, what I really wanted to sort of personalize is, you know, how this is affecting us in this country right here and right now. And so I sort of drilled down, and one of the places that climate change is really affecting is the California Central Valley in a lot of ways.
Can you elaborate on that? And
sure.
In what ways do you see?
Well, the two things that I found that I thought were really sort of very interesting about the Central Valley is, first, the bad air, and then also valley fever, which is an illness that's been sort of endemic in the Central Valley and got its name from the Central Valley. It's been around for, I don't know, hundreds of years, actually. There's been reports of it. But it's really starting to maybe a silent epidemic. The Centers for Disease Control calls it a silent epidemic, which one of the drivers really is this hotter, drier climate that we're getting in terms of climate change.
Can you elaborate a little more on that? Because these are conditions and things that are not new. We've had them for a long time, as you mentioned. What are scientists telling you?
There's several drivers, you know, so you don't want to just sort of blame climate change completely. And a lot of people are sort of looking at this. A lot of scientists are looking at it to see. But valley fever is caused by a fungus. And the fungus is carried in spores that, you know, live in the soil. And, you know, when you have excavation and sort of a movement of the soil, you're going to have the fungal spores, you know, sort of aerosolize. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, this type of valley fever where you have a lot of construction. And another big piece of it is these new weather patterns that are fueled by global warming. So you have a rising temperature, then you have droughts followed by drenching rains and parched landscapes, so that you have these more violent winds that kick up the dust clouds that travel for hundreds of miles. You know, and they've sort of created this perfect storm for the transmission of valley fever. These kochi spores burrow several layers beneath the soil surface, and then they benefit from higher temperatures because that encourages the fungal growth. And then what's more, during these scorching summer months, the intense heat kills off the surface vegetation, so when the rain does fall, the fungus flourishes without any competition. And because the hotter temperatures burn off the desert grasses, roots, and plants that anchor the soil, more dust can be roiled by the churning winds, which often carry the spores for, you know, 500 miles or more. And many scientists believe that as the environmental belt that's hospitable to the fungus widens with longer, hotter, and drier summers, the number of people stricken could, you know, greatly multiply.
And I think this is an important point because it applies not only to valley fever, but also other things that you talk about, natural disasters and the like. It's not just simply a rise in temperatures. We're talking about weather patterns, changes in moisture, precipitation, and things like that. You're seeing this affect a number of different things, correct?
Well, absolutely. Well, see, this is what people don't understand. You know, it's like, all right, so it's hotter. You know, but really what's going on is when things get hotter, it really changes the ecosystems. And that's what was really sort of fascinating to me, is to really sort of unpack that. You know, for a little example, a mosquito. And the mosquitoes are now surviving milder winters. You look at West Nile virus. And West Nile, I'm sure that people, West Nile has existed the first time they saw West Nile, and the reason it's called West Nile is that it was first seen in the West Nile district of Uganda, which is Africa, in the late 1930s. And I'm sure that there have been people that have brought West Nile over to the United States before 1999. But in 1999, because there were mosquitoes that could carry the virus, and because the weather patterns had heated up to the point where the mosquitoes could survive and the virus could survive, suddenly West Nile was able to become entrenched here in the United States. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that we're seeing, is that, you know, mosquitoes can now reproduce themselves twice instead of once, you know, during a mosquito season. So you're having an explosive growth in the number of mosquitoes. And as, you know, the planet gets warmer, you know, they're migrating northward. You know, I just did a story on, you know, my husband says I'm just a total nerd. I just did a story on, you know, the migratory patterns of the 80s albopictus mosquito. And the reason why we should care about this is because the Aedes albopictus carries West Nile, it carries yellow fever, it carries two different types of encephalitis, and it carries this disease that's actually endemic in Southeast Asia called chikungunya, which is really this really pretty, it's not fatal, but it's really pretty awful. But, you know, the Aedes albopictus was brought here from Japan and recycled tires in 1985, and it's migrated northward to Connecticut, and they fully expect it to be completely endemic in Maine within the next, you know, 10 or 20 years. So this means that, you know, people in those areas suddenly are vulnerable to these diseases that were once exiled to the tropics.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Linda Marsa. She's the author of a new book called Fevered: Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. It looks at the local impact to public health of climate change. And Linda spent some time in Central California researching this book, and I want to talk about some of these issues. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is this issue of CO2 domes. And this is a phenomena scientists have found in urban areas where CO2 levels can be up to twice as much as the global average. And you say that these CO2 domes actually act as something like pressure cookers for temperatures and things in these urban areas and exacerbate a lot of other problems, correct?
Absolutely. Well, you know, breathing in all that carbon dioxide and all those pollutants, we know that's not good. And we know that, you know, it causes asthma and all kinds of respiratory ills. But, you know, as we're, you know, dumping more and more of this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it is starting to form what's called these CO2 domes over cities, which are, you know, these sort of toxic clouds of pollutants. They're having this in Salt Lake City, which has actually, you know, sort of similar typography to the Central Valley. You know, the Salt Lake City is in a valley, too. So you're getting all that trapping of those stagnant air masses. And it was a Stanford University study, you know, that found, as you said, that these domes act like pressure cookers, and they exacerbate pollution's harmful health effects. And some of the harmful health effects, as I mentioned, is increasing asthma, you know, increasing allergies. And also they've linked pollution to heart disease because it causes plaque to form on the wall of arteries, and it thickens the walls of arteries. And even in some cases, dementia. There was one study that linked pollution, you know, high levels of pollution to dementia. So this is the kind of stuff that we're seeing. And this Stanford University study said that these CO2 domes may already be responsible for up to 1,000 excess deaths every year across the country. And, you know, in the Central Valley is sort of a microcosm of all of that because, it has, you know, really, really terrible air.
You spoke with a physician at UCSF Fresno, Dr. Jose Joseph, a physician there, and he said that we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg, essentially, in the public health impacts from not only air pollution, but the climate change that is the result of the CO2 that we're expelling into the atmosphere. Elaborate a little more on what he told you in your conversation.
Well, he was really quite wonderful. I really greatly enjoyed talking to him. But he really talked about this. I mean, he's a pulmonologist. He's seen, you know, he treats all these people who are sick. He's seen, you know, the rising rates of asthma. He's seen the rising rates of, you know, allergies. And, there's a lot of premature deaths. You know, they're predicting that in, 10 or 20 years, one out of every four children in the Central Valley is going to have asthma. That's staggering. I interviewed, people at the Clinica Sierra, who are really, very dedicated people down there. And, this one fellow was telling me that he's got, in every room, he's got kids on nebulizers and steroids. And he said, 10 years ago, I didn't see this. He said, it's really frightening. Because, you really don't want to put young kids on this very heavy artillery. And the problem is that, the lung development of children who live in these highly polluted areas, they've done studies on this, their lung development is stunted. It's about 20% smaller than average, which greatly impairs their lung function. They suffer from asthma at significantly high rates. And the problem is that this impairment follows them throughout life. So as adults, they're much more prone to have respiratory diseases and, have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and things like that. So these are the kinds of things that I was talking about with him.
There's a big concern in this part of the state with agriculture industry and a growing population about having enough water. The Sierra Nevada snowpack provides so much of what keeps this area alive in what was previously a semi-arid desert here in the San Joaquin Valley. There's a real concern by some that with climate change, the snowpack and the nature of the Sierra will change, and that could severely impact the water that both grows our food and sustains our communities. What did you hear from the people involved in water management and hydrologists that you talked to in this book about our ability to have sustainable water supplies for the future with global warming?
Well, I think that this is a very real concern. And I wish I could say that the news was good and that everybody had figured it out. But here's the good thing, though, that people are talking about this in a very intelligent way, and they're talking about this now. So that, it's not like we're going to try and go from a standing start 20 years from now when we have a water crisis. But you're absolutely right. They're talking about, building the peripheral canal. They're talking about all kinds of water management things. But I think the bottom line is that we have to be better about how we use water and conserve water. The other piece of this, and I know that this is sort of a detour, but it's not really, but the levee system in the Central Valley really needs to be rebuilt in a very sensible way because, with an earthquake or with, one of those Pineapple Express storms could just completely destroy the whole levee system in the Central Valley. So these are all things that we really need to deal with in a meaningful way. And I know a lot of smart people are talking about this, but I think that we really need to move forward on all of these issues.
There's also natural disasters and wildfires that are big concerns in regards to climate change and how rising global temperatures will affect both of those issues. As of last Friday in the West, there were 36 large active wildfires in 9 Western states. 9 of those 36 are in California, including one in Fresno County. Tell me a little more about what you learned as far as how climate change has the folks who battle wildfires concerned.
The fire story is really kind of an upsetting story. And just sort of, if I could just sort of digress just a little bit.
Go ahead.
If you recall in the President Obama's message, when he finally talked about climate change in that speech he gave at Georgetown University, he singled out firefighters. He said, here's a quote, "Firefighters are braving longer wildfire seasons, and state and federal governments are figuring out a budget for this and how we're going to pay for more expenses during fire seasons." So even the president, recognizes how important this is. And basically, this is sort of common sense. The hotter it is, the more it dries. And the more it dries, the more you have more kindling. So that's sort of one aspect of it. And by 2050, the USDA Fire Service expects that a changing climate could increase wildfires by 50% across the U.S. and over 100% in areas of the West. We have the years of drought, and the open spaces make this region especially prone. All right, and fire seasons are now more destructive in the past, and each year surpasses the previous one for record-setting fires just because it's hotter. The other piece of this which I find extraordinarily insidious, is, again, we've talked about how climate change changes ecosystems, too. So increasingly hot weather also alters ecosystems in ways that make forests more vulnerable to wildfires. So what we have now is that we have hundreds of millions of pine trees on millions of acres across the West have been denuded by bark or white pine beetles. And the insects bore through the protective bark on trees, and they infect them with this fatal fungus that kills the trees. So once the trees die, you left behind these brittle husks that provide kindling for these blazes. And increasing temperatures are largely responsible for the widespread infestation. The beetles are now able to survive warmer winters instead of dying in the frigid weather, and then longer summers enable them to reproduce twice a year instead of once, and then the beetles can fly further, extending their range, while warmer overall temperatures mean they can survive in higher altitudes and latitudes. In fact, you know, what one scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research told me is that, you know, in Canada, there are now fears that these bark beetles could wipe out the whole boreal forest, which is really very frightening.
And that would also, by wiping out a large forest that essentially takes in CO2, that only reinforces the problem, does it not?
Right. Well, it creates, there's two things that wildfires do to create feedback loops. That's one. That's one aspect. And the other one is, duh, you know, some of this stuff is like, you know, when you read it, you think, well, of course. You know, but wildfires pump enormous amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, you know, about 290 million metric tons annually, which is equal to 4 to 6% of the nation's CO2 emissions from just burning fossil fuels. So these large infiernos spew these massive pulses of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, you know, so that severe fire seasons are creating just as much greenhouse gas as vehicle emissions. So that again, you're creating more of these feedback loops.
Another concern that a lot of people have, especially in agricultural regions, arid regions, are dust storms. Certainly, farming practices are much better now than they were back in the Dust Bowl, but that is still a concern for many. Is that something that you're seeing in your research that is a concern for many in the West?
Well, I think that, well, we're seeing, I love this name, we call them haboobs. I've learned this whole new vocabulary, you know, derechos, which are these severe winds, and now we have haboobs, which obviously is an Arabian word, and you know, they developed it because they have haboobs very frequently on the Arabian Peninsula, and we're starting to see them here. You know, Phoenix was enveloped in this huge haboob. I think this was in 2011. It grounded planes. You know, everything sort of ground to a halt. You couldn't see. So I think we are going to be seeing more dust storms. Yes, we did have the dust bowls in the 30s. A lot of that was due to the combination of the drought and poor agricultural practices. We're much, much infinitely smarter about how we manage the land today than we did then. But I don't think that we can avoid the fact of having dust storms. You look at, you know, I spent almost a month down in Australia because Australia is really on the front lines of climate change. And they're smart, too, you know, about their, you know, land management practices. And they had a haboob that surrounded Sydney in 2009 that, you know, day turned into night. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to be having dust storms like this here, but it's possible in some parts of the country.
If you just joined us, we are talking with author Linda Marsa. Her new book is titled Fevered, Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. She not only looks at the problems, but also potential solutions in this book. And I want to talk about some of those right now, Linda. It's easy to say the sky is falling. Woe is us. What are we going to do? There's lack of global consensus on climate change. What do you see as some steps that communities can take to try to address this or mitigate some of these concerns?
Well, I have to say, Joe, that when I first started writing the book, I was in utter despair. You know, I'm talking to all these scientists, and, you know, they're telling me the sky's falling, and we're careening over the abyss, and no one's paying any attention. And then I started drilling down and talking to people in local governments and community groups and things like that, and people take climate change very seriously. There's not any debate. They're, you know, taking steps to prepare their communities for climate change and trying to smooth the path toward a cleaner, greener, healthier future. And I was extraordinarily gratified to see that. I know that in the Central Valley, there was a large movement to clean up the air. And I talked to some of the people who had been involved in that. And, you know, there was sort of kind of a retrenchment on that. But I think that, you know, if people get involved again, the air was cleaned up quite a lot. It still has a long way to go, and it's going to start getting a lot dirtier again as the temperatures climb. But I think that this is one thing that people can do. All across the country, I saw really wonderful programs. New York is really leading the way into becoming a very sustainable city. They're trying to set up ways of, you know, preparing for climate change, of, you know, sort of creating barriers against the storm surges that will come, but also, you know, building a new infrastructure for food. Right now, our food travels an average of, not in the Central Valley, obviously, but in other parts of the country, our food travels an average of 1,500 miles in order to get, you know, from the fields to our plates. It's absurd. I mean, think of all the energy that we're using. We've got to start eating, you know, locally grown foods. You know, another thing that all of us can do is we're just really incredibly mindlessly wasteful. We all are. That's one of the things that we could start doing is start really, you know, decreasing our own personal carbon footprints. Another piece is, you know, getting active, getting engaged, and start moving for, you know, changes that can be made. You know, we worry about water here in the West. There are two places here in the West that are leading the world in water management. Las Vegas, which is one of the driest cities and probably one of the driest states in the Union. There's a woman there, Pat Mulroy, who is the water manager in Las Vegas. She's well known. She's sort of a hero in water management circles because she's made Las Vegas, which is a very dry city, extremely self-sufficient. And she started in a very stepwise process because she said you can't make a population of 2 million people turn on a dime. First thing she did is she went to all the owners, you know, people like Steve Wynn, who owned all the big hotels, and she got them to recycle all the water from their fountains, from their golf courses, from all the places like this. And she not only got them to recycle, she got them to pay for it. That was the first thing. And then the second thing she did is she instituted this Cash for Grass program. And what she did is she paid people to pull up their lawns. She paid them so much square footage. And as a friend of mine, a reporter friend of mine, said if it was up to Pat Mulroy, she'd rip out every blade of grass in Las Vegas County. You know, and then the third thing that she did was she started she instituted some very stringent water management measures and water conservation measures. So the upshot is that the average use of water per person is somewhere between 125 and 135 gallons a day. And she got Las Vegas people to reduce their water consumption to 75 gallons a day, and she's aiming for 50 gallons a day. Now, in Orange County, California, which is, you know, just south of me, they're also world leaders in water management. And what they've done is, you know, in addition to conservation and better water management, they've instituted a toilet-to-tap groundwater reclamation program where they take toilet water and they purify it and make it, you know, drinking water. And 20% of the drinking water in Orange County, California, comes from this recycled sewage water, which if you go on my website, there's a picture of me in a hard hat happily drinking the water, which tasted just fine. But the point here is what they did, it's not just the technology to do it, but what they did is they did a community outreach program. They showed people that the water is safe to drink, and they brought everybody on board. And the program that they've implemented has become a template for cities around the world in terms of water management. And I could go on and on, but I saw really hopeful signs across the country of people doing really good things that were going to smooth the path towards a better future. And the one point that I keep bringing out is that a lot of these programs are beyond the pilot program phase. they have proved that they work. You know, they've kind of ironed out the kinks, they've come across the problems, they've resolved them. There's a lot of programs across the country that can be adopted in other places and on a national basis that are, to use the cliche, shovel-ready. So I was very gratified to see that.
One last question before we go, Linda. Why Central California? It plays a big role in your book. Tell me a little more about how that came about, how you came to spend so much of your time in this book about the global impacts of climate change on public health. Why Central California?
Well, I wanted to really paint a picture of what climate change looks like. And I wanted to go to places where climate change is already affecting people. I went to New Orleans, and one of the aspects of the book is dealing about what happens to the public health system after what they euphemistically call extreme weather events, you know, hurricanes, et cetera, et cetera. And what happened in New Orleans is that their public health system still isn't completely rebuilt, and this is 7 years out. And that's why I wanted to go to the Central Valley. I wanted to see, you know, we're dumping almost 32 gigatons of carbon dioxide in the air every single year, which is beyond comprehension. You know, one gigaton is a billion tons, which is sort of equivalent to, you know, twice the weight of every single person on the earth. So we're dumping 60 times the weight of every single person on the earth. And at some point, the CO2 is going to collect and have an effect on us. And in the Central Valley, that's already happening. And the Central Valley is already experiencing the kind of air that we're going to be experiencing over the rest of the United States in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. So that's why I came to the Central Valley.
We've been talking with Linda Marsa. Her new book is called Fevered: Why a Hotter Planet Will Hurt Our Health and How We Can Save Ourselves. It's out in stores now and on Amazon.com. Linda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.